Hello. Friends. I say that as a reminder before this journey that we're about to take. I don't know about you, but it kind of feels to me like everybody is angry about something. It feels like not only that we're not just a little bit angry about something, we're like really angry. And it kind of seems like it's going in the wrong direction. It kind of feels like it's getting worse. In fact, some of us might know someone who seems to be angry about everything. And it used to be back in the day, maybe you can remember these days, maybe you can't. It used to be back in the day that you had to know someone in order to be really angry with them. But nowadays, thanks to social media, you can be angry with total strangers. And like really angry with them, irrationally angry with them. Take this as an example. Last week, the White House, that would be not just a White House, but the White House where the president works in the United States, they posted this picture on their Flickr feed. This is Vice President Mike Pence meeting with the task force that are going to address the problem of the coronavirus. And prior to the beginning of the meeting, they decided to have a word of prayer in the White House. So there's the picture. Shortly afterwards, somebody posted this on Twitter, Mike Pence and his coronavirus emergency team praying for a solution. We are so screwed. Now, just to be clear, after they had their word of prayer, they didn't then go, well, that was a great meeting, let's all go back to work now. Like, they then had a meeting in which the experts and the CDC and all of these people talked about dealing with the virus. But because they prayed, this now clearly means that they're not going to do anything scientific, and therefore we're all, screwed. 20,000 people nearly liked this, and I kind of feel that's because Twitter only gives you the option to like it, but I kind of feel like when their like didn't mean like, if you know what I mean. Over 5,500 people retweeted it, and the comments are a fascinating sociological study of the sort of things that people are saying about this. Now, just to be clear, every single American president ever, well, just the men ones, every single one of them has entered their office with a word of prayer. It's part of the ceremony. It's part of the whole inauguration process. It's not unusual to see prayer and the American government connected together. But yet here we have this one moment, and this gives us a sort of extreme reaction that, oh my goodness, everything's done for because of this. And this isn't isolated just to people who are upset about prayer. When I was actually doing a little bit of reading this week regarding the coronavirus and its spread, I found one website that was blaming all of the hype and all of the panic on around coronavirus. They were blaming it on, wait for it, liberals. No, I don't know whether you're a conservative or a liberal, but kind of blaming them for all of the hype, like that's, liberals aren't that well organized to be able to organize the purchasing of that much toilet paper. And yet here we have this group of people saying it's definitely their fault. Alistair McIntyre in his great book After Virtue says this: there seems to be no rational way of securing moral agreement in our culture. You kind of want to agree with him. In fact, it's kind of hard to disagree with him, that there's something going on in our culture where we just don't agree well. Here's another sort of image that I'll show you that won't provoke any reaction at all. Now, there is the person of the year from Time magazine last year, Greta Thunberg. She was 16 years old at the point of this being awarded to her as Person of the Year. Regardless of what you think of Thunberg, she would be a divisive person in our media. So very few people have a kind of half-hearted view on Thunberg. She's either a really impressive spokesperson for the state of our world and its worrying environment, or she's this kind of ridiculous sort of spokesperson for the anti-oil and gas lobby or something like that. Regardless of what you think of her, let me just say this: the way that people have talked about her, and I include Christians in that, so us, the way that we have talked about her has been unkind. She's a 16-year-old girl, right? Now, let's all just be mature at the moment. Like, pretty much all of us are aware of the fact that a 16-year-old girl on her own doesn't generate the media attention that she has achieved, right? So somebody's helping her with this. But we don't seem to get mad at them. We don't comment about them on our social media pages. We comment about the 16-year-old girl. And we don't comment about her policies. We don't comment about the things that she's saying. We comment about her. And she's a 16-year-old girl. Like, you probably know someone that's 16. How do they cope with that level of vitriol and outrage? And how do they cope with being that leveraged by other organizations? Because the fascinating thing is she's being leveraged. I'm not talking about what you think about whether she's being leveraged, but what you think about what she's being leveraged for, but she's being leveraged by something. And that's creating outrage. It seems that our culture has got to a place that outrage is something that we leverage. These people are becoming experts at making us mad. Even just simply showing a picture like this, you heard it amongst us. There's differing views simply. It's amazing how much a groan tells you. That where we stand and what we think, but is what we think about this person actually what we really think about this person, or is there something else going on? You see, it seems to me that outrage is growing in our world. In fact, a recent Gallup poll showed that in a global survey that Gallup did, 22% of people described themselves as angry. Like 22%. Now, I'm not a statistician, so you're going to correct me on this slightly, but roughly speaking, that means that one in four, right? So that every fourth person you meet, the likelihood is they're defining themselves as angry. They're angry about something, or maybe they're angry about everything. And perhaps you've noticed this. We're getting angry a lot, and we're getting angry easily. We get triggered by the smallest of things nowadays. Maybe it's just a joke that somebody told that we don't particularly like, or a comment that somebody passed, or an image that we saw. But it also seems that instead of our anger just sort of dying down and going, whoa, that makes me mad, not only do we seem to get mad quicker, we stay mad for longer. And nowadays, with this wonderful invention of social media, we can take our anger, and before we've even done that much about it, 20,000 people have joined us in our anger. Perhaps we are an angry mob, which kind of makes it much harder for us to follow the ancient advice in the letter of James. Here we are in 2020, and we're talking about a text from probably 2,000 years ago. James says this in chapter 1 and verse 19 of his letter. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. This got me thinking about an imaginative process. Imagine a social media channel that was governed by the rules of James 1:19. Imagine when you opened up that terms and conditions document, before you ticked okay, you read it, because I know that's what we all do. And you read it, and there in the terms and conditions was, well, how this social media channel works is that when you see something, you have to wait 10 minutes before you can write something. Like, how much would that help us? If you just had to wait 10 minutes between the triggering and the responding. And so this sort of ancient wisdom from James is perhaps going to hang over the 4 weeks of this particular series. But I want to jump into another story this morning, a story that some of you will know quite well, some of you maybe not so much, but I just want to take us through a story from the life of Jesus. The story in question is from John chapter 8, and it takes place in the temple. The text tells us the story like this. At dawn, Jesus appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" And then John adds us this little comment here. They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. Now, before we go any further in the story, like that phrase just in the middle of that text there could almost be a phrase for our time. Now, what do you say? Like that could be posted on the headline for Facebook or Twitter or whatever blog that is that you read. What is your opinion? Here's a thing. What do you think about it? And we want a response now. So they bring this woman to Jesus, and John just gives you a little help when you're reading the story. He just points out, you kind of see it in the text, don't you? He just points out, by the way, this really hasn't got a great deal to do with a woman caught in adultery. Just in case you're missing that, that's not really what this story's about. This seems like that's what this story's about, but really, there's a bit of an issue going on between a particular group of Pharisees. There's a small group of people that don't really like Jesus, and they're trying to catch Jesus out. So just in case you think this is a story about a woman caught in adultery, John's going, yeah, it's really not about that. The story continues. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and he said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." That would be a really quiet social media channel. Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she replied. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." If we're going to talk about anger, it requires us to use a little bit of nuance. It requires us to sort of tread carefully and be aware of the sort of things that we're talking about. Today, I want to talk about the extreme side of anger, what we might even want to just refer to as outrage. And I want to use this story that we've just read as a kind of model and foil for us to kind of bounce some ideas around outrage in our thinking. Outrage is worth saying right at the very start, has very little nuance to it. Outrage is not something that is a kind of, it's not a fine tool, it's a big hammer, right? And what happens with outrage is it's normally motivated by a need to punish. Outrage is normally motivated by a desire to destroy. It also is driven by extreme confidence. Outrage, very few people that are outraged also say, "But you know, it's possible I'm wrong." You don't hear that so much. When somebody's really outraged, you know, outrage is fast. Like, you know, outrage isn't, nobody says, "Do you know what? And then my outrage built over a matter of weeks." You know, like, you know, I'm slowly getting outraged. No, outrage comes on us fast. It's decisive. You know, outrage doesn't see both sides of the story. It sees my side of the story. Outrage isn't reflective, and outrage doesn't seek to reconcile. Nobody ever says, "Man, am I outraged. I'm going to go and see that person, and I'm going to reach a compromise with them." Am I right? You know, like when you're mad at something, you got put in the wrong room, or you got the guy behind you on the plane with the long legs, you know, you don't go to the air host and say, "Do you know what? I'm just here to see your side of the story," right? Outrage says, "No, it's me and it's my story, and I'm coming at you." And our text today, I think, has a lot of outrage in it. Jesus is in this scenario, in this story. There's a woman in this story, and there's a mob of people out for Jesus in this story. And so I want to talk about a few aspects of outrage that we can kind of see in this story and hopefully reflect back into our own situation. In a recent book, Ed Stetzer wrote about sort of six characteristics of outrage that I think are really helpful, and I just want to explore them with us against this story of this woman, Jesus and this particular group of rabbis. The first thing I want to say about outrage this morning is that it is disproportionate. Outrage is rarely balanced. Outrage is rarely sort of the appropriate response to the situation. Outrage doesn't think a lot about intensity. When someone's outraged, they're not measuring their response. They're not measuring their angles. They're not really thinking about how they're coming across. All offense is treated at the same level when you're outraged. And even if your anger begins for good reason, and there are times in life where you might want to be angry about something and your anger might even be justified, but when it becomes outrage, it's kind of like a big snowball, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, it's just out of control and it's growing. And this woman is having an affair, okay? And they want to stone her to death. I kind of want you to kind of catch that is a slight overreaction to what she's doing. It's okay to say that, even in church, okay? Like, we don't stone people for having affairs. And you go, oh, wait a minute, they reference something about the law of Moses says that they should do that. Well, just to be clear, right, the law of Moses has a few angles to it on how you should treat someone that's having an affair, and we'll get into that in just a moment, but just to be really clear, like, nobody was doing that in Jesus' time, okay? They had kind of moved on from killing people for having affairs by the time of Jesus. This story would be like the following scenario. You turn up at your boss one afternoon, you go, hey, do you have a minute? I just would love to chat to you. Yeah, sure, David, I'd love to chat to you. What are you going to talk about? I want to talk to you about Jack, who works in the cubicle next to me. Jack chews his nails while he's working, and I find it kind of gross. So I just wanted to invite you at noon to the duel that we are going to have in the street. The boss is going to go, hey, you know what, David? They used to do that a few hundred years ago, but we don't do that now. So these guys come to Jesus, and sometimes because we read this story from thousands of years later, we go, oh, obviously that's what they did in those days, that somebody got caught in an affair, everybody kills them. But no, that's not what was happening. So this is a completely set up and ridiculous scenario. It'd be like us referring to some ancient law and trying to apply it in the here and now. The anger and the outrage is disproportionate. And I wonder if disproportionate approaches to how we do things is what gets us in so much trouble. You know, if you study philosophy, eventually you'll start to learn about just war theory, where the idea is that even when countries go to war, proportionality is in their thought process. It's about how do we respond appropriately. I sometimes wonder if we need like a just social media policy. You know, how do we engage with each other when we're angry in a way that's proportionate? The other thing about outrage is selfish. Maybe, I don't think I'm the first person to notice this, but unloading your anger kind of feels good, right? Like if you're outraged about something and you get to let it out, you get to unload on someone, you get to tell that person what it is that's really kind of just ticking you off, there is a little bit of a moment, let's just be honest, that we walk away feeling kind of good. You know, I'm going to tell this story to my friends later because I told them. You know, and maybe it was someone that had wronged you, or maybe it was just the perception of being wronged. But when we're wronged by something, or rather, let's just set that baseline low, when we feel that we've been wronged by something, we kind of feel a little bit out of control. So if we get to unload our outrage, it kind of gives us that sense of power and strength again. The Pharisees, though, this particular group of Pharisees, they're in this kind of fight with Jesus, and this fight's gone on back and forward. There's been various arguments, and Jesus seems to always have an answer for the sort of objections that they have to him. And the kind of fear amongst the Pharisees at the time of Jesus was that Jesus was this kind of liberal preacher who turned up, and he was kind of breaking all the rules, and he wasn't following the way that things were supposed to be. The Pharisees of Jesus' time, we often think of them as the bad guys, and that's a really bad way to think about them in these stories. The Pharisees were just the kind of religious right of their day. They just wanted to make sure that everybody followed the Bible. That was they weren't great at actioning that. I'll give you that. But they just wanted to keep everybody on the right track. And Jesus came along and he seemed to just be really graceful, and he was letting kind of boundaries drop where people didn't want boundaries to drop, or these people didn't want boundaries to drop. And so what happens when you have an idea and you think everybody should follow this idea, and then somebody else comes along and they have a slightly different idea and everybody seems to like it, outrage starts to develop because you start to feel like you're a bit weak and, And maybe you start to feel a bit afraid and fear and feelings of weakness. They don't really help us when we're trying to control our anger. So what happens is this whole story is really about the Pharisees. It's about this group of people who are angry at Jesus. The story is about them. The anger is actually about them. It's a very selfish encounter. Because so often my anger is driven by what's going on in me, right? It's actually my story that's creating the tension. It's my story that's causing me to respond in particular ways. It may be, you know, maybe from a kilometer away, it looks like a piece of justice. So maybe if you stand far enough away from this story, you go, okay, these Pharisees were concerned about the moral culture of their city, you know, and maybe from a kilometer away, you can kind of make that point. When you get up close to it, you realize, nah, this is kind of ugly. This is a selfish problem that's going on with these particular Pharisees. And I can, the same can be true of me. Maybe from far away, I can look sometimes like I'm concerned about injustice. But when you get up close, so often my anger has its roots in my own issues. But all outrage becomes so divisive, doesn't it? Like, outrage draws a battle line in the ground. And this is particularly challenging, I think, at this particular cultural moment for those of us, you know, well, let's just say in Canada, but it's true across the world, but we're becoming very tribal. You know, I have my group of people, and they have their group of people, and anybody that attacks my group of people, the people that think the way that I think or believe the way that I believe or just have standards that I think are the standards we should have, anybody that attacks them, it's attack on our clan. Even notice in this story how Jesus is in this story, and John, even in his telling of the story, you can kind of feel the battle lines in the story, can't you? Outrage creates these divisions. Outrage is always focused on the other, on them. And they, like, they're evil and they're wrong and they're also ugly and, you know, and stupid too. And we push these people sort of away because outrage does that. It divides us. But here's the problem. As we're pushing these people away and we're raising our own shields against them, we become hugely inconsistent. Have you noticed how so often the criticism that we lay down at the feet of the other is a criticism that we're not prepared to assess of ourselves? So what we'll criticize those people about, if anybody asks, well, hey, don't you guys do that? Like, whoa, that's offside. Like, you know, like we don't criticize ourselves the same way as we criticize somebody else. We'll attack behavior from this side, but if the same behavior happens on our side, there's probably a good logic to it, right? You see this in our political discourse, and you don't even need to be a major in political science to track this, but, you know, a politician spends some money. If the politician's one of your guys, it's just great fiscal policy. If the politician's one of their guys, like, he's ruining the economy. And you don't need to look far to see that. That sort of thing is happening all the time. We switch governments, and the thing that we decried the previous government for, now our government continue to do it, because apparently it's kind of complex running people. And so as soon as these guys now continue to do it, now we go, wow, you know, we understand it a little bit more now. And we offer grace to our own side that we won't offer to the other side, because outrage divides us. And it's also visceral. Like, outrage is rarely well-reasoned. It's your gut reaction, isn't it? You know, you don't actually come to a conclusion by nice discussion or clever thinking. It's just whatever comes to me first is what. You see the headline, you catch the tweet, you hear the comment, you just engage with a fraction of the news, and particularly in our soundbite culture, we just catch the right little amount of data, and now I've made my opinion, and don't try and help me with the what's and the whys or any complex, you know, context. I don't want to hear it differently. It seems that once I'm triggered, if I am triggered, you're going to hear about it, and I'm going to tell you, and tough if you don't like it. It's not reasoned critical thinking. It's just whatever comes, which kind of, you know, in this story that we're telling today, kind of makes you want to think, like, where's the man in this story? Like, in Jesus' time, you had to have two people to have an affair. In Jesus' time, and so we have this mob, right? And if you don't read the story too closely, because it's a little awkward, we caught this woman in the act of adultery, right? So I don't know how many children are in the room, so let's not just spend too that. But there's a guy missing from this story, right? And Moses' law is very clear on the process that if you're going to accuse someone of adultery, you need to have both parties there. But it's almost as if this mob has sort of thought, here's a way to catch Jesus. So they just grab this woman, and the next thing, they're in the temple. You know, something happens, you know, that whatever the big sort of, you know, outrage du jour comes along, and we find ourselves thinking, right, I got to respond. You can't turn up at the water cooler on Monday morning and not have a comment on what it is that happened in the news last night. So, you know, somebody says, hey, did you hear about what such and such a thing said to such and such a somebody? Have you read my blog? I already posted my open letter of complaint to the whole world so that everybody can see my initial reactions. Like we live in a culture where everything's instant, and if we don't pour it out now, then it's not really valid. But that's not always well thought through. And essentially, we become the lynch mob of the world operating on half a story. And because we've got half a story, we only have this woman here, and therefore that gives us another side of outrage, which is that it's domineering. Like, this story is deeply uncomfortable. And part of the reason it's uncomfortable when you hear it, and the story might even be triggering for some of us, is because the way the woman is treated in this story, she gets no voice. She doesn't get to speak until the very end of the story when finally Jesus has silenced everyone. But she is silenced, she's shut down, and she's shamed. You know, there's no question that she's having an affair. And there's not even a question in the story that that's probably not a great way to go about living. Jesus even is on record at talking about a better way of life involves not having affairs. Like, that's not, you know, this is not like Bible quiz time. Like, nobody in the story is going, hey, it's okay to have affairs. That's a really wise idea. But that's a sidelining issue. If you read this story as a story about people having affairs, you're never going to be able to get to the bottom of what the story is actually about. See, because the story... Well, the story shows us something about outrage. Is that outrage divides the world into winners and losers. Not into right and wrong, into winners and losers. And it is possible to be biblically right, but unbelievably wrong. And we forget that so often in our outrage as Christians. That as long as the text is being followed, as long as we're doing what it says, then we're in the right. But you can be in the right and do it in a really wrong way. And this woman is just being abused by this whole scenario and this hyperbole, this insults and this shaming, and it's shutting her down. And it's not really assessing what's actually going on in this story, because outrage just wants to be in charge. And finally, therefore, one of the things we have to confess about our own outrage is that it's dishonest. The Pharisees were trying to trap Jesus. It's not about this woman. It's just a sham trial. It's a foil in order to have another argument. And too often, I think our outrage is just trying to score points. It's just trying to win. It's trying to, and we'll do whatever it takes in order to win. We're not really overly bothered about what the truth is as long as we walk away victorious, as long as we have won the engagement. And what then starts to happen is we start to attack people rather than ideas. So even though this whole story is about an idea, Jesus has an interpretation of the law that this particular group of Pharisees, they don't particularly like. And they don't particularly like this, the Jesus' interpretation, and this woman becomes the sort of foil by which they move all of that, and she becomes attacked in the story, but the story's not really about her. Maybe it's worth us sometimes thinking about how do we talk about people, because so often, and you see this in our political dialogue, we mentioned Greta Thunberg already, you see it in just our engagements with one another, so often what happens is it's an idea that we're upset about, but we take it out on a person. And it becomes personal. And we start to attack people. It doesn't really matter what sort of logic could be applied. It doesn't matter what kind of discussion could even be had. What I'll do is I'll share the quote or that soundbite or that video reel that just makes those people look foolish or stupid or ashamed. In a post recently on the subject, Michael Gerson, who writes for the Washington Post, said this: how we order our outrage says much about us. Do we feel the violation of a religious rule more intensely than the violation of human dignity? Do we prioritize our religiosity above our anthropology, above our theory of human beings and their rights? Because you all know, of course, that if you've got people who are outraged, what really settles the situation down is if you add religion to it. Like, that really calms everything down. Gerson asked a question just last year in this particular article that I think is a question for the story that we read in John chapter 8. Do we prioritize our religiosity above our anthropology? I think we too quickly forget that this woman is an image bearer of God. And therefore, what we do is we put our beliefs above her humanity. And we take this story and we say, yeah, but what do we think about her having an affair? And the moment we've done that, we're now asking the theological question, forgetting that there's an actual human in the story. Let's beat Jesus, say this particular mob. We can take this woman, we can get her to Jesus. Jesus will be totally stuck because he won't want to say to everyone, well, you know, I'm not so sure we need to worry about the law of Moses stoning people today. And then everybody will be mad because it will be proved that he is the heretic and we can get rid of them and then we can win. I don't think any of this mob are saying to themselves, hey, you know, what sort of psychological damage do you think we're doing to this lady? I don't think that question's been raised at any point during the whole scenario. And how often is that question never asked by any of us in our outrage? What damage are we doing? We just want to win. And probably most of us can read this story and go, yeah, this is a really terrible story, right? This is not a good story. I don't like this story. I don't like the way this story's going. But is that just because it's a biblical story and we've kind of been used to hearing a biblical story for such a long time that we know that's our proper answer? So, you know, what if this story wasn't about a woman having an affair? What if the story was about a gay man or an indigenous woman or an immigrant child? What if the story was about a liberal or a conservative? Do our beliefs overwhelm our anthropology? Does our view of what right should be like forget that there's a person on the other end of that social media channel, that there's a person on the other end of that phone line, that the person the other side of the desk has a family, has priorities and structures and a life? Does that get so easily forgotten because our outrage has now engaged? Which does lead us to the core part of this story, which is ultimately to point out that nobody in this story other than Jesus cares about this woman. They're not angry at her. They're not even bothered about her. They're angry at Jesus. And that's what's driving this whole narrative, which kind of leaves me uncomfortably asking myself this question, a question I should ask myself more often than I do. What am I really angry about? Like, you know, I have Celtic blood. So anger is not a distant thing for me at any point, you know. Give me an axe and I'll find an Englishman. And but what am I really angry about? Like, when I'm angry at something, what am I really angry about? You know, so say, in terms of my job and life, you know, I teach a sermon on a Sunday morning, I say something somebody doesn't like, okay? Which happens. I say a lot of things, and much of them are offensive, so I apologize. But so somebody decides they want to write to me about it, which again is completely legitimate, and I'm open to people sharing their thoughts. And somebody shares the thoughts, but maybe they don't do it in the kindest of ways. And that might be because of their own anger at the situation. And I don't know that story. I just have what I have, and I look at it, and it makes me angry, perhaps, or it upsets me, or it makes me annoyed, or whatever. Now, I know what I'm supposed to do. What I'm supposed to do is email that person back and say, hey, listen, appreciate your views, and maybe we don't see eye to eye on this. Perhaps we could chat about it a bit more, or perhaps here's my side of the story. You know, let's work this through. I know that's what I'm supposed to do, but how often is what I actually do is I'm just really grumpy to everyone else at work that day? You know, how often does my wife and my daughter pay for the penalty? Because not because somebody emailed me, that's not, it's because I can't process my anger. So instead of actually seeking kind of reconciliation, instead of actually seeking to put all things back together again, I just let it fester. Now I know nobody in Canada does that. But how many of our loved ones, of our friends, of our colleagues, have actually found our anger directed towards them when we're not actually angry about that? Because outrage kind of leads us off in destructive paths. And what happens is that what's actually right and wrong just becomes side issues. And it becomes too easy to even forget what it is that we're actually angry about and instead just choose to live angry. And we just live in permanent outrage, and just whoever happens to come across our path finds us angry. Some of us are angry with everybody because of stuff that happened years ago. Some of us are angry at everything because of something we've seen that isn't even in our country and doesn't even affect us. Some of us are angry about legitimate things, but we're just processing it really, really badly. And regardless of what the reason for you being angry is, if you let it boil up into outrage, right and wrong and the reasons become distant spots on the horizon. And we end up just choosing to live constantly outraged. The Hebrew prophet Micah famously advises us in a better way. He says, God, he's talking about God here, he says, God has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Well, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Outrage rarely involves justice, mercy, and humility. In fact, almost never. They're in short supply when these things take over. And yet Jesus, he crouches and writes on the ground. Even though the text says they kept questioning, and Jesus just quietly crouches, bends over, and starts to write on the ground. Jesus, what do you think? What do you think? What should we do? What should we think? What do you want? What do you say? What do you say? What do you say? While you're trying to be calm and quiet, the outrage is still circling around you. It's still getting retweeted. It's still getting shared, and it's still in the news stream. So how are you going to respond? My friend Jerry Fitch, who's a psychologist and also has an adjunct professor in counseling, will be here next week to talk to you about how we can maybe manage some of our anger. And she's going to talk to us a lot about this issue of how we pause and just take control of our situation. So I'm not going to steal anything from her, but it just strikes me that Jesus pauses in the middle of this story and calms it all down. And then he comes away with this amazing line, you know, if you don't have any sin, then go ahead and rage. If you've got it all together, rage away. But you see what Jesus does? It's genius. I think Jesus is a genius. I hope that's okay. And what Jesus does is genius, because actually what he does is he erases the line in the middle. He takes away them and us in one sentence. Because what he says to them is actually, we're all in this boat together. And you can want to throw stones at her, but are you any different? Because outrage needs the division. Outrage needs sides, and Jesus just wipes all of the sides away. He erases the battle lines, the otherness, and he says, instead of thinking me, we're now going to think we. And so what Jesus is essentially doing is he's giving us a model for how to act Christianly. And I want to just identify them real quickly just as we finish up. Well, the first thing Jesus does, I think, is just straight out of James's playbook. Be quick to listen and slow to anger. You know, just take your time. You know, stop shooting from the hip. It seems like it's this kind of desirable quality nowadays in our culture. Like, oh, I love that guy. He shoots straight from the hip. You know what happens when you shoot from the hip? People die. People get injured. People get maimed. People get hurt. Stop shooting from the hip. Take a breather. If Jesus himself can pause, you're in good company. The second thing that Jesus does, by the way, you know, just this, well, hey, where is anybody that condemns you? Well, they are not here anymore. Well, then I don't condemn you either. Like, it's not our job to correct every wrong. It's not our job to put everything right. It feels like our job is to be the moral police, but if Jesus himself says, do you know what? I'm not going to bring any condemnation in this story. He points out to the lady that there's a better way to live, but he doesn't bring the condemnation. And so often that's what we want to do. And finally, I just simply, maybe we ask this when we're in a place of outrage. What are we trying to accomplish? The mob want to accomplish destruction, and Jesus wants to accomplish reconciliation. And so when we let our rage loose, when outrage starts to build in us, can we pause just long enough to ask, what am I trying to accomplish here? And so for me, what Jesus is maybe telling us is that to speak Christianly, or perhaps to type Christianly, or just to act Christianly, might involve us doing less, might involve us speaking less, might involve us quietening down. Maybe you don't send that tweet. Maybe you don't write that email. Maybe you don't have that conversation. The distance between the keyboard and the send button is very, very short, but completely permanent. And so often what we do is we don't allow enough time between the typing and the sending, between the thinking and the talking. And maybe, just maybe, we can just breathe a little more slowly. Stanley Hauerwas phrases it in a beautiful way like this. He says this of us as Christians: the church requires a certain kind of people to sustain it as an institution across time. They must be a people of virtue, specifically the virtues necessary for remembering and telling the story of a crucified Savior. They must be capable of being peaceable among themselves and with the world, so that the world sees what it means to hope for God's kingdom. In such a community, we are not free to do whatever we will, but are called to develop our particular gifts to serve the community of faith. Let me pray a blessing over you this morning. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9, Jesus simply says this: blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. So may you find a way to be a peacemaker, because peacemakers are blessed, because they have given up their outrage. Amen and amen.